and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this hour, we continue our regular Friday segment called The Week in Review. We talk with Jacqueline Lookman and special guest Professor Jody Dean. We cover the implosion of the Democratic Party leadership in Virginia, why Donald Trump has declared war against socialism inside the United States to be central to his ongoing political campaign efforts, new exposés about the Trump-led coup in Venezuela, the war against women's rights and the new block from the Supreme Court on a stringent anti-abortion law in Louisiana, and much more.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Acting U.S. Attorney General Matthew Whitaker testified today before the House Judiciary Committee, and it turned confrontational. In response to a question by Chairman Jerome Nadler, Whitaker snapped, quote, "Mr. Chairman, I see that your 5 minutes is up. I am here voluntarily. We have agreed to 5 minute rounds," unquote. Democratic and Republican senators set a deadline of today for the Trump administration to publish a report on the parties responsible for the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Senators today introduced a bill to punish Saudi Arabia for Khashoggi's murder. The border city of Nogales, Arizona, passed a resolution condemning the use of concertina wire, also known as razor wire, due to its lethality and proper use in military zones. The city council called on the federal government to cease its use and military tactics in their city. Mayor Arturo Garino said at the meeting that Nogales is very safe and that, quote, "We have children who live right next to it, 10 feet away from it," unquote. The United States Steel Corporation founded Gary, Indiana in 1906 and once employed more than 25,000 people there. That number is now down to 4,000. And the city and state have offered the company a package of $47 million worth of tax breaks to come back. However, the company plans to automate and has not yet publicly committed to keeping the 4,000 jobs that still remain. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
It's Friday, and that means we turn to our weekly segment called The Week in Review. We talk about the week in politics, policy, and international affairs with Jacqueline Lookman, who joins us here in the studio. Jackie is the editor of Lookman Nation, or editor-in-chief. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined from Geneva, New York, by Jody Dean. She is a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. And her latest book is Crowds and Party. Jackie and Jody, welcome.
Thanks so much.
Good to be here.
Thank you for joining us. A big week. We want to go over a lot of issues. Of course, there was the State of the Union address that has a lot to do, again, with Syria, with Afghanistan, Venezuela, the upcoming Korea summit, abortion and abortion rights and women's rights. There's a lot to talk about. But before we get to the State of the Union address and the attendant issues, let's talk, Jackie, and start with you about the implosion. I'd say it's an implosion of the Democratic Party in the state of Virginia.
Yeah, being a native of Virginia, I was born in Jarrett, Virginia, so I'm well versed in the history of racism in the state, and it's always been like a very polite, genteel kind of racism. I think people look at Virginia as not as the South, really, but only because of Northern Virginia, but they don't take into account the history of massive resistance where Governor Byrd.
It sure was Governor Byrd.
Legislated that public schools, that private segregation academies be created so white kids wouldn't have to go to federally integrated public schools anymore. And that went on for a while. And a lot of those academies still exist. So there's a lot of that going on. So what's happening in Virginia with the pictures of blackface in blackface posing with people dressed up like the Klan and pictures of mock lynchings from Virginia Military Institute and the medical school that Ralph Northam went to, the AG now admitting that he posed in black. None of this is a surprise to black residents of Virginia because we are so used to even white politicians, even white Democrats, I should say, showing up at the same Confederate commemoration banquets and events that white Republicans do. So this is not a party issue. This is a white racism issue. This is a white supremacy issue that's finally rearing its ugly head publicly.
Jody Dean, go ahead.
I think that's such a perfect point. I would even say it's not a surprise to any white Southerner, right? White Southerners know full well that white supremacy is part of what it is to be a white person in the South, that blackface has been something that has been part of college parties and that these Confederate flags are everywhere. So there's a kind of disingenuousness in acting as if this is some big shock, rather than this is what normal life is within a particular segment of the, you know, Southern, among Southern white people. So the one good thing about it is now this reality can appear as a scandal. Maybe it can be addressed, but it's not a surprise. It's not new.
Yeah. And also the lieutenant governor who would be in line to take Northam's place, also another scandal and sort of breaking just at the moment that it appeared that he was about to ascend to the position of governor, and the allegations are very serious. Go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, I mean, while it's true that, you know, this history of white supremacy is being exposed for what it is and that it's always been there, there is also the question of the political gamesmanship that's going on here with these photos being released by probably the Republicans. And then you have the allegations against Fairfax, which are actually not new. They have surfaced. They surfaced before during the campaign. So there is some question about that. But I think it's important to point out that Northam himself wasn't very fair to Justin Fairfax. So during the campaign,
well, there's no love lost between the two
no
of them.
There's no love lost between the two
Northam
of them.
Northam considered Fairfax to be a kid.
Exactly. So Fairfax really was never, even if these allegations never resurfaced, it was going to be a long tow, a long road for Fairfax to ascend to the governorship. I don't think it would have happened. I mean, something detrimental would have had to have happened to Northam, like him being indicted and forced to leave office, which I don't see that happening.
And don't forget, too, they have very significant ideological differences. Northam campaigned as the anti-Trump.
Right.
Even his campaign commercials specifically attacked Donald Trump. But just a decade earlier, Ralph Northam was a registered Republican who had endorsed George W. Bush for president over John Kerry. And, you know, he's a relative newcomer to the Democratic Party, and lifelong Democrats like Justin Fairfax just simply didn't trust the man.
Yeah. And Northam has come right out and said that he is a fiscal conservative and a social liberal. Well, that means he's a moderate Republican. So there was never a clear path to the governorship for Fairfax. All of that being said, it does not mean that these allegations against Fairfax should be dismissed as just, you know, political brinksmanship. This is some serious stuff. And the Democratic Party is looking just as shady as the Republican Party always has.
Well, Jody Dean, let's just move before we go to some of the other big issues of the week. Let's just go to that. I mean, to that issue, we have the issue of all these white guys coming out in blackface. And by the way, 1984 isn't like 1884. It's 1984. It was 2 years before Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday became a national holiday. I came to Washington, D.C., by the way, and Virginia's right across the river, in 1981 for the first time. I mean, to live here for a while. And I was surprised that Virginia was actually celebrating Robert E. Lee's birthday, not Martin Luther King's birthday. But Jody Dean, when you think about racism and sexism, racist, really the racist caricaturing of black people, the stereotyping of black people, the attacks on black people, and the extreme misogyny and attacks on women, which are so routine, it's not a partisan issue. It's the Democrats, it's the Republicans, it's elites. It's not even simply amongst the elites. Anyway, go ahead.
One of the things that I think we see really clearly in these Virginia scandals is the deep interconnections between patriarchy and white supremacy and political power. Now, in our country, we also know full well that political power is a kind of economic power, and it arises directly from a class position. And so we can see really easily how the capitalist class relies on white supremacy and the power of men over women to consolidate its authority, to consolidate its hold on society. And And that these elites are, you know, throwing these accusations back and forth in their own political way. I mean, they're, you know, their own kind of cynical political way. That's real. But it also gives us a nice little inroad into saying, like, okay, how far can we possibly push in a more progressive direction the criticisms of patriarchy and the criticisms of white supremacy, and use those to mobilize a more grassroots politics. So I think there's a huge cynicism here, but the cynicism reflects the structure of power that the elites have, but they also give an option for ways that we can push back against it.
Let's segue to Donald Trump's State of the Union address, because the issue of racism and misogyny were on full display Tuesday in front of the whole nation. Again, I want to play a short clip from Donald Trump. It's talking about some of the guests, or one of the guests, or a family, guest family that he brought to the State of the Union, whose parents had been killed by someone who was an undocumented immigrant. I want to play that clip, and then I want to play a clip from Bernie Sanders, which came later in the evening and is a response, a direct response to Donald Trump's assertions. Let's listen first to Donald Trump.
Here tonight is Deborah Bissell. Just 3 weeks ago, Deborah's parents, Gerald and Sharon, were burglarized and shot to death in their Reno, Nevada home by an illegal alien. They were in their 80s and are survived by 4 children, 11 grandchildren, and 20 great-grandchildren. Also here tonight are Gerald and Sharon's granddaughter, Heather, and great-granddaughter, Madison. To Deborah, Heather, Madison, please stand. Few can understand your pain. Thank you, and thank you for being here. Thank you very much.
Yeah, again, using people who are victims of a terrible crime as nothing other than a political prop. And it's pure racism. Jody, go ahead.
First, it was horrible that we had to sit through that again. But anyway, one of the things that's really striking about that clip and the speech as a whole is the way that Trump manipulates essentially an unstated trope of white women as victims in this racist way. So women are victims. And what are they victims of? They're victims of some person of color who has somehow violated their maternal sanctity and thereby the sanctity of the entire family. This is an old, old trope in the United States. It goes back to the legacy of slavery and the legacy of Jim Crow laws and lynch law. And it's terrible. And we shouldn't let him get away with it. I mean, there's further. He was also manipulative in talking about violence against immigrant women who are in the caravans, totally excluding the fact that maybe they're in large groups for protection, totally excluding the fact that the United States has itself a terrible record of not protecting women, of using violence against women for its own militaristic, police, violent, racist purposes. So it's a completely manipulative, racist politics that tries to act as if it cares for women, as if it's concerned with women's health, concerned with women's bodies, when there is nothing in any part of U.S. policy that ever reflects that concern.
Go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, I cannot disagree with anything you just said. That was absolutely, absolutely correct. And I will add that Trump's entire speech was just one big white supremacist, nationalist, imperialist clarion call to his base, who, you know, you have this family that is literally in the midst of grieving the violent loss of their family members, but they're willing to come to the White House to be symbols of the invading brown hordes that are violently coming across the border, creating this violent crisis at the border that does not exist. There are not countless murders being committed at the border by immigrants. And the mayors of border towns will tell you this. The Customs and Border Patrol, for as much as we can have problems with them, they will tell you that's not true. But this is something he continues to say. He spent a lot of time demonizing immigrants. And I think what's more disturbing for me was that beside the family being willing to be pawns in this racist game, but The people in that chamber who applauded those lies, knowing full well that they're lies, and just being willing to go along with this racist white supremacist narrative, just lets you know that, you know, where we still are as a nation and why.
There were two responses from Democrats after the, there were more too, but two in particular. Stacey Abrams, who gave the official response for the Democratic Party, she came directly after Trump. Her address was about 10 minutes long. And a little bit later was Bernie Sanders. And Bernie Sanders' comments were an actual direct rebuttal to Donald Trump's speech. Stacey Abrams had written the speech, I think, beforehand, because it doesn't really rebut Trump directly at all, in fact. But let's listen to Bernie Sanders, because he sort of takes Trump on regarding this incident, this crime that was committed in the state of Nevada. Let's listen to Bernie Sanders.
Trump has talked time and time again about crimes committed by undocumented Latino immigrants. His demonization of Latinos is nothing less than racist. It is wrong, and it also happens to be factually inaccurate. Undocumented Latino immigrants commit fewer crimes in the United States than the general public. But I want you to think about something for a moment. Isn't it strange that when we talk about terrible crimes committed in the United States or in the state of Nevada, Donald Trump forgot to mention that in 2017, a white man named Stephen Paddock killed 58 people and wounded 851 in the deadliest shooting in modern American history.
Yeah. Jody Dean, I'm glad Sanders did that. Again, it's, what a contrast. I mean, how can you talk about violence in Nevada in particular, recent violence, and let that one go? And of course, if you want to demonize a category of people because the person who committed a crime happens to be from that category of people, you could certainly have said, like, hey, let's go after white men. I mean, this was a massacre that was really without precedent. And again, no mention of it.
Yeah, Trump is clearly playing to his base. And many of the people in his base are white men. And many of these white men are very much pro-gun. And many of these white men are anti-immigrant and racist. And so there's not the reality here is that Trump's not concerned about the families who were, you know, victims of violence in Nevada, whether or not they were the families who came to the White House or the victims and families of the Las Vegas shooting. What he's concerned about is mobilizing his base in order to protect the billionaire class and to get his wall. I mean, it's pure blatant politics. And at this point, our political system is one where they don't even bother to try to tell the truth, to try to have a degree of factualness. They can just have blatant lies. And so I think Sanders was right on the money. And what he also points out with his example is, where was the discussion of gun violence in the United States, right? Where's the discussion about the protests led by all of the Florida kids, right? Where was the discussion about the problems of opioid addiction, the change in life expectancy in the United States? So we don't have that. Instead, we have this beautiful world under threat from black and brown bodies. That's the world that he's presenting.
Just imagine, John, if the shooter in Las Vegas had been a Latino immigrant, you know, shooting 800 plus people, or a Muslim.
We'd have martial law today.
Yeah. I mean, that's the reality, everybody. I mean, and again, people are being manipulated on the basis of pure racism. I mean, even if I don't know what the ethnicity is of the victims of the Las Vegas shooting, they're probably black people and Latino people and lots of white people. It doesn't matter. These are all victims. And yet what Donald Trump is doing is so clearly based on racial and racist caricaturing. And again, you know, I would say, I have to just say right out, I think that Donald Trump's, the real purpose of Donald Trump's State of the Union address, his message was the message of the 2020 campaign. And that's against immigrants. And I want to also go over a very, I would say, normally it would have been a weird sort of reference in his speech, but maybe not given what's going on. And that was his attack against socialism.
Yeah.
Donald Trump is the first president I can remember in recent history who made a pledge to the American people that America's not about to take the socialist road.
Right. Ignoring the fact that we're already pretty well into socialism in this country.
Yeah.
And so here's what he said. Here in the United States, we are alarmed by new calls to adopt socialism in our country. America was founded on liberty and independence, not government coercion. He's obviously not talking about the enslaved people there.
Right.
Domination and control. We are born free and we will stay free. Tonight, we renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country. And the whole place erupted with the Republicans.
And the Democrats.
And the Democrats applauding.
Yeah.
I mean, Jody Dean, this is the second part of his campaign for 2020. Why? I mean, you're a socialist. You're an academic. You've written books about socialism. Why do you think Donald Trump is declaring America's not taking the, quote, socialist road?
I think there are at least three reasons. One, he might be positing that Bernie Sanders is going to have a strong possibility of getting the Democratic nomination. So he's attacking him in advance. Second, he's attacking the issues that polls are showing are really the most important to the majority of Americans, which is healthcare, the economy, as in economic inequality, living wages, and also healthcare and the cost of health insurance, Medicare for all, and of course, the high expense of college tuition. So there's a whole basket of socialist issues that are polling really, really well now, and he's attacking that in advance. And I think trying to draw a line there. I also think the third reason takes us away from the State of the Union, maybe, and is about Venezuela. It's also part of the general Trump administration's attack on Venezuela and likely Cuba. And so it gets, again, in this big picture, the demonization of socialism lets him do a lot of work. So attack the basic issues and advance his imperialist objectives in the hemisphere.
That's Jody Dean. We're talking to Jody Dean and Jackie Lookman in this hour called The Week in Review. We have this segment every Friday. After a short break, which is coming up soon, we're going to come and focus more on Venezuela. Let's go back to the issue of socialism. Jackie, I want to get your take. Donald Trump campaigning against socialism. Now, there has been a revival of interest in socialism, a popularization. Maybe it's not well defined. Well, it's certainly not well defined. It can mean it's kind of like a bag you can put anything into at this point. But nonetheless, it also means that there's a rejection of capitalism as philosophically and as a social system. There is a struggle going on in the Democratic Party against what might have historically been the liberal wing, not the socialist wing, but it's going a little bit under the label of socialism. I think the Democratic Party establishment, too, is very alarmed about Bernie Sanders. And the fact of the matter is, Bernie Sanders actually could be a much more formidable candidate than any of the neocon sort of centrist Democrats for somebody like Donald Trump.
Absolutely. And that was part of the whole Democratic response to Trump's comment, because they stood up and applauded, too. And that's where that ridiculous meme of Nancy Pelosi seeming to sarcastically clap at Donald Trump comes from. That's the point in the speech where that comes from, where she's actually clapping for real in response to him saying that, you know, America will never be a socialist nation. And somehow people thought that she was clapping back at him. But no, she was clapping in agreement against America moving towards socialism, even though socialism as a kind of vague concept, like you said, is becoming more popular among younger voters. The idea of a more economically just or equal society has always been popular among marginalized people, Black people, Native people. And that's the thing with socialism, right? It's regardless of how you define it and whether it has worked in other countries or not, the ideals behind socialism suggest that the people on the bottom become more empowered, and then they become a threat to the people on the top. And that is a threat to even Democrats.
And in some ways, Jody Dean, if you think of the economic system being like a pyramid, where the broad mass of the majority is at the base of the pyramid, and at the very top, in that very small pinnacle, is the very, very ultra rich, the billionaires. I think the billionaires think about socialism as turning that pyramid upside down.
What's great about the pyramid turning upside down is that then the weight of the bottom crushes the tiny little pinnacle at the top and eliminates the billionaire class. So I actually think that they should be afraid of it being turned around and or turned upside down, because there's absolutely no way to have anything like democracy if you have billionaires. It really is the case. If billionaires, no democracy, because they can exert such an outside, enormous pressure on every bit of government policy that everybody else remains perpetually catching up, perpetually on the edge of survival, perpetually struggling even to have a future. So the billionaires are right to be afraid if we can only get the Democrats out of the way so that we can push the socialism we need.
John Kiriakou, you know, again, socialism isn't well defined. And of course, now people will start to define it and there will be different definitions. But President Obama, when he became president in January 2009, said that he wanted to introduce a new health care plan. And right. He crafted the Affordable Care Act, now known as Obamacare. It was Mitt Romney's plan from Massachusetts.
Yeah, Obamacare.
Yeah. And then the Republicans called that communism, even though it was, or socialism, even though it was a Republican plan. And then everybody started to go to the Merriam-Webster dictionary and look up, well, what is socialism?
Yeah.
And they thought, oh, well, that doesn't sound so bad. And then as a consequence, or the unintended consequences of this red baiting of Obama, there was actually a renewed interest in socialism. Go ahead, John. 1 minute left.
Let me tell you one thing that I really love to do. It's not a very nice thing to do, but I do it with some frequency. I happen to be sitting at a family event recently next to a woman who's 82 years old, and she's addicted to Fox News. She watches it 20 hours a day. And she said to me, very, very seriously, we're becoming a socialistic country. And I thought, okay, I'm going to have some fun. So I said, you know what? I agree. I think we are becoming a socialist country. And if we're going to stop socialism, we need to do away with Medicare and with Social Security. Because what is Social Security? Really, it's just welfare for old people who were either too stupid or too lazy to save for their own retirements. And she looked at me like I was crazy. And I said, well, Social Security is socialism after all. And she says, well, I live on Social Security. I said, exactly.
Exactly.
All right. Well, good way to take a break. We're speaking with Jody Dean and Jackie Lookman. I'm Brian Becker, joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. After a short break, we'll be back and we'll continue to look at the big stories of the week.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's time for our weekly segment, The Week in Review. We spent the first half hour talking about some of the big issues of the week. We're going to do the same in the second half hour. We talk about the week in politics, policy, and international affairs every Friday with Jacqueline Lookman, who joins us here in the studio. Jackie is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined from Geneva, New York by Jody Dean. Jody is a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Her latest book is Crowds and Party. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
All right, let's go now to Venezuela. Big issue this week, of course, following it being a big issue last week, because the U.S. government is trying and is exercising through many, many different channels, a coup against the sovereign, democratically elected government in Latin America. Let's start by listening to Donald Trump again talk about the Trump line, the Trump program for Venezuela, again presented at the State of the Union address.
2 weeks ago, the United States officially recognized the legitimate government of Venezuela and its new president, Juan Guaido. We stand with the Venezuelan people in their noble quest for freedom, and we condemn the brutality of the Maduro regime, whose socialist policies have turned that nation from being the wealthiest in South America into a state of abject poverty and despair.
Well, of course, Donald Trump obviously doesn't know anything about Venezuela, because while Venezuela was always quote, rich because it had a lot of oil. The level of poverty in Venezuela was so catastrophic. 1% of the population owned 70% of the land, even in more of its wealth. Massive poverty, massive illiteracy. Most Venezuelans before Chavez, the majority of poor people had never been to a doctor. Jackie, this isn't a full-blown effort, not just to carry out a coup. It's a brazen effort. It's out in the open. Juan Guaido is not the elected leader of Venezuela. Nobody ever thought of him like that. And frankly, most Venezuelans, when he announced that he was the new president, had never heard of Juan Guaido.
Right. And people are using the unfortunate misdirected argument that, you know, Maduro is a terrible leader. He's a dictator. He's a monster and all this kind of stuff as justification for the United States implementing a coup in this country. But here's the thing, regardless of what Maduro is or is not, has or has not done, this is the same guy who just accomplished building 2.3 million affordable or free housing units for Venezuelan people in a so-called socialist evil dictatorship country. But this country, what, 30 people died freezing to death on the street last week. So we can have all kinds of arguments about the kind of leader Maduro is.
Including
two college students.
But as they froze, as they slowly froze to death, they were probably thinking in their last thoughts, I'm so glad I live in American democracy.
At least I'm free and living in a democratic country. But the fact of the matter is Maduro was elected by 6 million Venezuelans voted for him. Not one voted for Juan Guaido. 80% of Venezuelans had never heard of the guy before. They're like, who is he? So we're not imposing democracy on a socialist nation. And it was sanctions against Venezuela that created the poverty and the economic instability, not socialism. So we're not imposing democracy on a socialist nation. We're imposing a capitalist takeover, a capitalist coup of a democratic socialist country.
Jody Dean, go ahead.
I think that's a really important point about the imposing of the capitalist coup, because in addition to the sanctions, of course, the collapse in oil prices has had a huge effect on the Venezuelan economy. And we also heard hints in Trump's State of the Union of at least one of the causes of this would be the U.S. glutting of the oil market and the rapid increase and dramatic increase in U.S. oil and gas production that's also come about from fracking as the U.S. tries to become basically more of an exporter than an importer. So we have a glut of oil collapsing the oil prices, and we have the U.S. trying to take control over more and more countries that produce oil, right? We did the same thing in Iraq and by military means, and now we're trying to do it first with this capitalist coup, and we'll see if it leads to military means. But I think it has a lot to do with oil and the U.S. trying to be in control.
Indeed, it does. And, you know, one of the things that Trump mentioned in his speech was the number of the millions of people he said had fled Venezuela. Now, Venezuela is in a full-blown economic crisis. It's had a precipitous drop in its gross national product. It's about a 50% drop. There's numerous causes for it. The price of oil in Venezuela is basically a single commodity country, the way Cuba used to be a sugar, Venezuela has oil. The price of a barrel of oil was about $112, $114 a barrel in 2008. After the economic crisis, it dropped all the way to $28. So for a country that's dependent on oil, that took away a huge part of its funding. There are other problems as well. Economic sanctions, most notably. I'm sure there's mismanagement. If you read Maduro's speeches, he's talking about mismanagement and corruption all the time. Now, if you use the criteria of people leaving their country and going, say, to richer countries as the barometer for whether the social system is a failed system or not, why not just go to all the capitalist countries in Latin America, like, say, Mexico or Honduras or El Salvador? People are leaving their country. Or remember in the 1990s where like one third of all young people from Ireland fled Ireland during the economic sort of implosion of Ireland. I mean, if you use those standards against capitalist countries too and say that shows that capitalism has failed, you can go all around the world and document lots of capitalist failures. Yes, it's a sign of economic crisis that people are leaving. It's got a multifaceted set of reasons, But what we're witnessing today is it's like having a thief come up to you, John, and putting a gun to your face, and you're about to be murdered or have all, or be relieved of all of your possessions. Now, you're the victim of that assault. You're the victim of that aggression. Would you at that time say, you know, it's true, John might be a victim of this terrible crime, but he did make some bad investment choices in the past. I mean, you just wouldn't. I mean, that's what we're witnessing. We're witnessing a mugging, an international mugging against a sovereign country that has a lot of oil.
Yeah, and nobody saw a thing. This mugging took place in broad daylight, and the EU saw nothing, and the Lima Group saw nothing, and everybody's pretending that everything is fine. This is exactly what's wrong with American foreign policy, and it shows the weakness of other countries around the world that talk the talk, but then when push comes to shove, they're not there to support democracy.
Yeah, and you think about it. I mean, 103 years ago, the U.S. marched into Haiti, occupied that country for 19 years, took all of its gold, brought it right back to Citibank in New York. It was then called First National Citibank of New York. They just went in and took the gold. They took Haiti's gold. Now you have the U.K. working with the U.S. They just took Venezuela's gold. 103 years ago, they didn't have to say they were fighting for democracy in Haiti. They just took it. But because of modern sensibilities, the same imperial looting and plundering and pillaging has to be given a noble cause. Let's call it democracy.
Yeah, and the really disturbing thing on this subject from the State of the Union address was that the Democrats applauded this. They applauded this. They've been supportive of this regime. It's not regime change anymore. It's just a coup. They're not. I mean, I think maybe for the first time in U.S. history since we've been staging coups and implementing regime change in the world, we didn't use the CIA. Mike Pompeo and John Bolton just used a legal notepad and just came out and said, we're going to take Venezuela's oil. This is such a disturbing and kind of frightening confluence of events where you've got the Democratic Party that's supposed to be the resistance to Trump cheering him on in toppling a democratically elected leader of another country.
Then the so-called resistance from the top disappears. I want to do one more little piece about Venezuela and then go on to the issue of abortion, because there was the important Supreme Court ruling yesterday about Louisiana. And again, Donald Trump spoke directly to this at his State of the Union. But I want to read to all of you a couple lines from today's Wall Street Journal. Now, again, we just heard Trump say, I have recognized the legitimate government of Venezuela. Again, okay, here it is, Wall Street Journal. Guaido's plan was a surprise to allies. His move against Maduro was kept secret from many in Venezuela's fractious opposition. This is today's front page. What appeared to be a carefully calibrated policy to oust Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro was actually a big gamble by a small group of opposition leaders acting on a hastily assembled plan. The strategy marked a coup of sorts. This one within the country's notorious fractious opposition, which had been locked in debate over whether to negotiate with Mr. Maduro or take more direct action. When Juan Guaido declared himself Venezuela's interim president on January 23rd in front of a crowd under a broiling sun, some leading opposition figures had no idea he would say that or what he would do. They included a few standing alongside him on the stage. A stern look of shock crossed their faces. Some quietly left the stage. Quote, what the hell is going on? Close quote. One member of a group of politicians wrote to others in a WhatsApp group. How come we didn't know about this? I mean, that's really...
And that's from the Wall Street Journal.
Wow.
That's not from the World Socialist Review.
Juan Guaido got off the phone with Mike Pence, walked up on that stage, and declared himself to be president of Venezuela, and even the opposition leaders, and those were the well-known opposition leaders, all but three. The other three people, and as we go through this Wall Street Journal article, one is Leopoldo Lopez. He knew about it. He's in prison for violence. And the other two were, quote, exiles. So actually, Juan Guaido was the only person in Venezuela who was not in prison, who actually knew that he was about to announce that he was, in fact, the new president of Venezuela.
Well, guess what? I am the prime minister of Canada. Now you know.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing, Jody?
It's really quite astounding. And it is clear evidence that this is a coup orchestrated primarily by the United States. And I'm still kind of shell-shocked about this being in the Wall Street Journal. And it makes me wonder, what was going on with the different regional and European state leaders who endorsed and supported this? And the only thing that comes to mind is that it must have something to do with, you know, capitalist class power, with the power of corporations and financial elites, with a particular version of how the world is carved up and in whose interest. Because there's clearly an absence of any political support at all for Guaido coming into this, right? It's a shock. It's just something coming out of the blue. So it really, to me, raises a lot of questions about why did other global leaders jump on board this?
Yeah, I would say it's the coalition of the bribed and coerced. And of course, you have Bolsonaro in Brazil and the government in Colombia. I believe what's coming, because they really can't overthrow Maduro on this basis. It's too fragile. It's too small. It's too limited. They're trying to, of course, drain the country economically, the sanctions. Now they're seizing all the assets. I mentioned the gold. They're turning that gold over to Juan Guaido, by the way, a $1.2 billion in gold. And the U.S. is taking the bank accounts of Venezuela that are in American banks and seizing those and giving it to the opposition. Just, again, it's like the analogy I made of somebody sticking a gun in your face and saying, we're going to relieve you of all of your possessions now. It's thievery on a mass scale and on international scale.
It's like it's going back to the era of imperial looting that you described at the beginning. And the appeal to democracy is withering away so quickly that it doesn't even seem like it matters anymore. It's like they pay lip service and then quickly just go into the looting and there's no secret.
And talking about dictatorships, we're going to make mention of Saudi Arabia before we end this segment, because Donald Trump has until today to submit a report about who the White House believes killed columnist Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Of course, he was killed and dismembered. The Saudis are saying it was, I think it was an accident. You know, like when those guys brought those bone saws in the part of the, anyway.
Completely accidental.
We're going to get to that later. But before we do that, I want to switch topics again to talk about the issue of abortion. There was a very, very important ruling by the Supreme Court, although it won't be the last ruling. It's a transitional ruling about the efforts by the Louisiana state government to basically snuff out abortion rights in Louisiana. But before we talk specifically about that case and what it means, let's listen again to Donald Trump speaking at the State of the Union.
There could be no greater contrast to the beautiful image of a mother holding her infant child than the chilling displays our nation saw in recent days. Lawmakers in New York cheered with delight upon the passage of legislation that would allow a baby to be ripped from the mother's womb moments from birth. These are living, feeling, beautiful babies who will never get the chance to share their love and their dreams with the world. And then we had the case of the governor of Virginia, where he stated he would execute a baby after birth. To defend the dignity of every person, I am asking Congress to pass legislation to prohibit the late-term abortion of children who can feel pain in the mother's womb.
Jackie, go ahead.
Okay, I had to get past hear him say that again.
I know. It's really hard. We're torturing our guests and the audience by having to listen to Donald Trump over and over again.
First of all, a baby taken from a mother's womb minutes before birth is called a C-section. That's just what it is. It's and the baby is not murdered. There is no woman that lies on the birthing table and after her child is taken from her womb, looks at her baby and says to the doctor, you know what? No, never mind. I forgot. I can end this right now. There's no doctor who does this and brings a baby out of a mother's womb and says, you know, I can take care of this for you right now. That's not what happens. We're talking about extreme and extremely rare cases where fetuses, babies are unviable outside of the womb, or in an extreme case where the mother's life is at risk. Those cases are so rare and so extreme. But he completely left those facts out, and he basically just described a C-section and called it murder, and people cheered.
People, and mostly men.
Thank you for, yes, mostly men.
Go ahead, Jody Dean. I mean, this is a direct, what we're witnessing is a full-scale assault against women and women's rights in the most core, basic way.
Absolutely. That's one of the things that makes this, you know, so disturbing is, on the one hand, as we talked about earlier, women's rights, the safety of women is being used in this racist way to attack people, you know, trying to escape from political and economic violence in their own countries, trying to migrate to the U.S. And now in the name of women, they're supposed to be kept out. And now here in the name of women, or in the name of the dignity of every person, women are denied any kind of autonomy or right over their own bodies. And it would be really nice to see both political parties saying that actually what really matters is a woman's capacity to make her decisions with her doctor about her own health and the health of her children, right? And just stop there, right? Just stop right there and let women have the kind of dignity that Trump claims that every person's needs to have, and that every person's dignity should be defended. I think that full stop should be the way this discussion goes. Back on this baby, you know, ripped from the mother's womb and executed, Jacqueline was completely right about that. One of the other things about this part where would the baby die afterwards, that's only if the child was on some kind of life maintenance as soon as it was born because of its severe, I don't want to say the word deformities, but it's severe problems that made it an unviable child. And the question there is, in its really rare cases, of whether or not to try to maintain a life of a child at that point that is really, really barely viable and only being held on by artificial means. And the doctor is waiting to give the parents a chance or the mother a chance to make that final decision. That's what the medical part of that decision meant in Virginia. And it's been completely distorted by misogynist anti-women's health advocates in the name of the rights and dignity of the unborn. And it's a scandal. Also, as Jackie rightly said, these are really rare cases. And they're cases almost always when the mother and or the fetus have already really severe problems that they're facing. And the utter insensitivity to that is one of the things that's really striking, and which lets us know that these policies come out of misogyny more than anything else. There's no love for children that comes out of this. If there were love for children, then there would be free health care for all children and all people. There would be good educational programs for children. There would be good family leave policies. But there's none of that. There's just this fetishism of the unborn, which is really just supporting misogyny.
You know, this is the problem with the Republican Party, too. And I don't mean to sound harsh, but I really believe this. For the Republican Party, life begins at conception. They're very clear about that. But it essentially ends at birth, right? Because once a child is born, that's it. Conservatives, Republicans in this country see their commitment to the life of that child as over. They don't vote for money for Head Start. They don't vote for money for child health programs. They don't vote for money for anything. So once that child is born, that's the end of it. With that said, they want to make sure that child is born, whether you want it or not.
Right. So really, they're not pro-life. They're pro-birth.
Exactly.
That's it.
Precisely.
That's it. And I have to say that, I have to make it clear, I am a Christian. I take my faith very, very seriously. And I have personal feelings about abortion, which is why I personally have never had one. But it is not in my right as a voter, as a woman, or as a Christian to tell someone else what they can and cannot do with their body. That's not my job on any level.
Jody Dean, the Supreme Court didn't take the Louisiana case, which means it fails. The Louisiana law enacted in 2014 and has been mired in court battle since requires doctors who provide abortions to hold admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of where the procedure is performed. The state measure resembled a Texas law that the Supreme Court struck down in 2016. The court then, without the two conservatives, Trump appointees, and conservative, let's not call them conservative, they're just anti-woman rights appointees, also had put the Louisiana law on hold during an earlier phase of the litigation. Now, we see that the court is moving steadily to the right. If Justice Roberts is now the center liberal, that really says something because he's so far right. And we have Kavanaugh, we have Gorsuch. Again, the courts at the Supreme Court level, but the Trump administration is stacking the courts with these hard right, far right, anti-woman judges. And when I say anti-women, I mean anti-women's rights because some of them are also women. And these are all justices who have been picked basically by the Federalist Society. They've been planning this takeover of the judiciary for 30 years, 40 years, and it's actually working. Such that, you know, at a certain point, absent any sort of judicial defense of existing rights for women, it becomes a clarion call, really, for grassroots mass movements to swing into action because the majority sentiment in the country, and certainly the majority sentiment among women, is that women and women alone should be the deciders of whether or not to give birth.
Absolutely. And one of the things that makes the need for a ever stronger and multifaceted movement of women in the streets is the fact that, I mean, we can't let the future. We can't go back to the days of hangers and back alleys. Like that's a non-starter. And yet our rights to make decisions on our own body are hanging by a thread. And on the one hand, you can say, well, aren't states like New York helping here, right? So New York State quite effectively passed legislation just this week that promises to guarantee women's rights to make decisions on their own reproductive health, even should Roe v. Wade be whittled away. That's great. But what about the women who live in other states? You know, the strategy of the anti-abortion groups over the last 20 or 30 years has been really effective at chipping away state by state, law by law, chipping away women's rights to an abortion such that it's really poor women who are the most disadvantaged, as with so many things. But say, let's say in, like with the respect to this law that had been overturned already in Texas that Louisiana was trying to get through. This one with the admitting privileges. Well, so it makes it harder for there to be abortion clinics. What does that mean for a rich woman? It means she gets on a plane and goes someplace else. No problem. What does it mean for a poor woman? It can mean that she has to take time off of work, that maybe she has to pay a lot of money for gas, that maybe she has to get a bus ticket, that maybe she has to get childcare. It means that basically she has to go through an unbelievable amount of time and effort just to get a right that a wealthy woman can get pretty easily. So there's a huge class dimension as well as a gender dimension to the ways that this whittling away at women's rights to abortion has.
Yeah, it's actually about working class and poor women.
Yeah.
Because again, people of means will find a way to have an abortion. And what Jody is saying is absent the right to abortion, it doesn't mean abortion will disappear. It just means it will be unsafe, criminally unsafe, and almost impossible otherwise for working class and poor women. It's a kind of a form of class war against working class women.
It absolutely is. I mean, it's interesting that in this ruling, the justices didn't rule on this case based on like the merits of the case. It was just because of the previous rulings and the fact that the court found that no woman was significantly helped by these restrictions. Not one. The restrictions did not help a single person. So there was legally no reason to continue to uphold these restrictions. And just on a personal note, what you just said, Brian, about women with means always finding a way to provide or obtain an abortion, that's true even in the so-called conservative Christian community, because I have attended churches with women who will sit in a church service and they will talk about the right to life and they'll attend the rallies every year and talk about how protecting life is the ultimate job for a Christian, but they will go to get their daughters an abortion. And it'll be whispered in small group meetings, but it's done. But they don't want that done. They don't want anyone else to have that option.
We're going to leave it right there. That was the voice of Jackie Lookman. Jackie is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we were joined from Geneva, New York by Jody Dean. Jody is a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. And her latest book is Crowds and Party. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can check us out every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM. In the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.